Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's October 5th, 39 degrees currently in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, Leslie. Hey, good morning, folks. Yeah, we've got kind of copy and paste to repeat forecast from what we've been seeing the last couple of days up in Park City. We've got more sunshine, clear start as you can see to the day. Temperatures climbing into the upper 60s once again this afternoon with mostly sunshine. Winds will be light out of the southeast, 5 to 7 miles an hour into the afternoon. So more copy and paste forecasts for Thursday, Friday. Highs near 70 degrees, overnight lows in the low 40s. We're continuing to see sunshine as high pressure is in place across Utah. And so that clear sky pattern will likely continue into the weekend as well, if not mostly sunshine. Saturday, Sunday, highs back in the upper 60s, near 70 degrees. So this is that perfect time of year. No big changes into the weekend. I think by next week, we're going to start to see some changes. We're still trying to fine-tune the forecast on timing, but we're expecting a trough to move in sometimes Tuesday or Wednesday. So enjoy the clear skies. Pretty seasonal temperatures for now into about Monday, Tuesday next week. We'll start to see temperatures drop and expect some showers, possibly, I think, even some good mountain snow into Tuesday night, maybe Wednesday. So looking forward to some of those changes by midweek next week.
Okay. All right, Nate, thank you.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with High Valley Transit District Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez. Will get an update on Monday's groundbreaking for the new transit facilities as well as winter operations. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias will be in with Transportation Director Matthew Neely with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. And finally, Summit Community Gardens Executive Director Sloan Johnson will have a gardens update, basically being putting the gardens to bed. And stay tuned for the Mountain Life. That'll follow the local news hour. Today's guests include longtime Park City resident and professional wellness and recovery coach Brooks Atticott. She presents a new movement in the greater Park City area, recently forming Club Free, a group with the aim to embrace, support, and advance sober fun culture. Then one of Fortune magazine's most powerful Black executives in corporate America, Carla Harris, talks about her new book, Lead to Win: How to Be a Powerful, Impactful, Influential Leader in Any Environment. She examines the journey from individual contributor to effective leader. Again, all of that happening on The Mountain Life, and you can, of course, hear The Mountain Life every Wednesday morning between 9 and 10. It's 8:08. News time now, 8:09. Good morning. Well, with its 1 million square foot base complex newly approved, the Mayflower Mountain Resort is one step closer to becoming the country's newest ski resort. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on that.
Just off U.S. Highway 40, across from the Jordanelle Reservoir, the Mayflower Skier Services Complex will be one of the busiest and most visible areas of the new resort. That's partly because the site's just a few hundred feet from the roadway, but even more because it'll be the new largest building in Wasatch County. Xtel Utah is developing the Mayflower. Vice President of Development Brooke Haunts told KPCW in a recent interview the plans to begin construction next spring.
It's kind of the front-facing and back-of-house central building that provides all of the guest services that you typically see in a day skier lodge. And so it's a very key piece to the coming together of the entire resort, and specifically the ski beach and the area we call the Ice Ribbon Plaza.
The tallest building in the complex could reach 13 floors, including 6 underground. Xtel Utah executives presented the plan to the Board of the Military Installation Development Authority, or MIDA, which is the state agency overseeing the resort development. The complex is designed to include more than 300 hotel rooms, more than 100 condos, a fitness center, commercial space, and restaurants. The design the board approved Tuesday estimates the project to be over 1.1 million square feet. The complex will be situated between the base area ski lifts, parking lots, and a plaza with ice skating. During summers, Haunt said the resort will repurpose the skating area for roller skating and use its ski beach for concerts. The Mayflower Skier Services Complex isn't cleared for construction yet, according to Wasatch County Planning Director Doug Smith. Next, the project just needs building permits. To view conceptual designs of the resort, visit the web version of this report at kpcw.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
KPCW News time now, 8:11. It's 8:11. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, as we've reported, High Valley Transit broke ground on its new transportation facilities this week. In the studio with an update, she's actually on the phone with me now, the Executive Director of High Valley Transit, Caroline Rodriguez. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you got a U.S. Senator and a Congressman to join you for the grand opening. They just happened to be in town campaigning, or?
Nope. We invited them, and because it did work out with their schedule, they made a specific point to come and be there for the groundbreaking because it's such an important project for both of them.
Yeah. The federal government was instrumental in getting this off the ground. How so?
So when we are applying for these discretionary grants, they're extremely competitive. And so we look to our federal delegation to advocate for us in Washington, D.C., and speak with our federal funding agencies to let them know that they really support the projects that we're working on. And so these members of Congress, and Senator Romney in particular, were very vocal in talking about High Valley Transit and what we're doing and why it's so important to the Wasatch Back.
All right, so how much of a grant did we receive then?
So on this project, we received just over $8 million in federal funds, but they also helped us with the $25 million we received for the bus rapid transit. You know, what you've heard me say this a lot, but when we're talking about public transit and High Valley Transit in the Wasatch Back, we're really talking about all of our services together and how the system works together, and that includes the bus rapid transit, micro transit, and our facility.
Sure. So what's getting built then? What did we break ground for?
What we broke ground on is the facility campus. So the first building that will go up is an indoor bus barn for parking and charging, and that will hold 24 full-size buses. Then people will start to see the maintenance building go up, and then finally the operations and admin building with the second story housing.
All right, so what's going to get done first then, the indoor bus barn?
Yep, the indoor bus barn will get first. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, will get done first. And that's so not only do we have somewhere to park our vehicles indoors, but also we can move our maintenance team out of their tent and they can operate within the bus barn until their maintenance facility is constructed.
Okay, so is that going to get done then this next year? Is that how
yes.
long it takes?
Yep, that's the goal. The goal is that we will start to see things going vertical towards the end of February 2023. And by August 2023, that first building will be done.
All right. So do you have an overall project cost, or are you just doing it kind of piece by piece?
We do. We're still right in the $26, $27 million range. Of course, as we start to secure more supplies and equipment, prices are going up, as everybody knows. That's no surprise to anybody, and we're sort of hostage to the market, just like everybody else.
Yeah, so you've received the $8 million grant. You've bonded, I think, for what, up to $16 million?
We put out a bond for up to $18 million, but we've only drawn down on the $10 million, and we're hoping that's all we'll need to. We do have some fund balance. We will have a request into the state legislature for funding again this year. And we are still going to be pursuing other grant opportunities while construction is going on to supplement that.
Okay. The $10 million is being repaid with what? I mean, it's a free bus service.
Yep. So we bonded against our sales tax revenues, and just as folks have heard on your reporting, sales tax revenues in the city and the county are up, and we budget for that. So we're not spending down all of our projected revenues. Part of that goes back into the bond payment.
Okay. So when does this first facility, when does it open?
So again, we'll be opening the bus barn just as soon as we can get in there, and that's probably August of 2023.
Okay.
And then the full entire campus, we hope, will be open mid-24.
All right. So are you going to finish that before moving on then to the maintenance and operations and administration buildings?
Nope. We'll see the maintenance buildings start to go up as we're still constructing the bus barn. And that is for a variety of reasons. Obviously, we want to get everyone out of Ecker, but also because we get some economies of scale if we bid multiple buildings together, if we procure all of our materials and supplies in larger quantities. So the construction will basically be ongoing for a year and a half.
Okay. So again, we had heard, I think, last month that you did not get a grant that you were hoping for. Tell me what happened there.
Oh, yes. So we had applied for a grant for some of the specialized equipment that would go into the maintenance building. And we were not successful there. As I said, these grant opportunities are very, very competitive. But we'll keep applying and, you know, we just keep working towards it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to kind of winter operations. You guys ready to roll?
We are still down drivers like everybody else in the whole country, but we have a good pool that we're training up and getting certified with their CDLs and hope that we will have a full staff of drivers by the time winter rolls around.
All right. Are you proposing any new routes or are we going to see what we saw last year?
We are actually expanding into Wasatch County, so we'll have a fixed route between Heber and Park City. And also in Wasatch County, they are adding some micro transit service zones for that first last mile connection to the fixed route.
Okay, so tell us about that then. Where is that fixed route? Where does it take people?
Yep, so it'll be right down Main Street. It'll start at the Intermountain Hospital in Heber and just come all the way down 40 into town, into Park City. And then from there, folks can connect, of course, to Park City Transit or the 101 Spiro on the High Valley Transit side. The easiest way for folks to understand what their trip is gonna look like is to download the High Valley Transit app and we'll do all the trip planning for you. And then remember, if you have a second leg of your trip that requires microtransit, that will already be booked for you while you're riding on the fixed route. So that's the easiest way to do it. You don't really have to think. Your phone tells you exactly what to do.
Yeah. How many stops along US 40 before you hit Park City?
I believe it's 5. Don't quote me on that. You'll start to see a lot of public information come out in the next 2 weeks. But of course, it's a longer trip, so the stops are extremely limited. We just want to be able to move folks between Heber and Park City. We're not doing local routing. This is really intended as that commuter style route.
So where does it drop people from Heber? We're in Park City.
Yep. The Park City stops are going to be at the hospital, near the high school, and at the AFRESH, because, of course, that AFRESH is the transfer point that everybody wants to be at.
Okay. And then at what? Goes up into the Old Town Transit Center and turns around?
Nope. Turns right around at the AFRESH. And we did that because of the density of routes that hit the AFRESH. So essentially, wherever you're going to on the Park City side or on the county side, if you get to that AFRESH point, there's always going to be a very quick, seamless transfer for you. And that was the best place for us to deliver our customers. And then on the operational side, we're saving, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes by just going to the AFRESH and turning right back around.
Okay, so we're going to be using smaller buses then, or vans for that then, huh?
Well, so that depends on what types of vehicles we can get our hands on by the time that service launches. So at this point, we think it's going to be what we call mini buses. So they are buses, but they're smaller. We are also looking for full-size 40-foot buses, but they are very, very hard to come by, especially on a quick turnaround. So we'll see what we can do. But the minibuses are brand new 2022s. So they will be nicer than any 40-foot bus that we could find and put on the route immediately.
Yeah. But I guess I just say, so the turnaround then is that they're going to go down Iron Horse. Is that correct?
So we're actually relying on our operations team to determine that turnaround. And they're doing some testing to see what the best alignment is there and what the turnaround will look like. We haven't dialed that in yet.
Okay, because you do like right turns as opposed to trying to make a left onto Bonanza or even a left onto Park Avenue if you're coming from the other way.
Yeah, we prefer right turns. Not always possible, but it's definitely our preference.
All right. Let's see. So when does that start?
So we are targeting November 13th for that start.
Okay.
And I just want to let folks know that you'll still start to see this Heber routing and the Heber microzone, and potentially if Park City moves forward with their micro service, the Park City microzone in the High Valley Transit app. There's going to be a lot of warnings that say this is testing, you can't book this right now, but people will start to see that as we do app testing and get those service areas programmed into our app.
So let's talk a little bit about moving that microtransit for Park City. That's on the contract is on the council's agenda for Thursday, if that's where they decide to move forward with. It's about a $850,000 contract, I think. If that does go through, just making that assumption, we've got an app for Park City Transit. Do they need a separate app now? They're going to have to use the High Valley Transit app to get that microtransit booked?
Yep. If you want to book microtransit in Park City, you're going to need to use the High Valley Transit app. The High Valley Transit app has both Park City Transit and High Valley Transit micro and fixed routes within it for trip planning. So if you want one app, all routes are contained in that High Valley Transit app. But yes, you will need High Valley Transit's app to book your micro, or you could call our phone number if you would prefer to talk to a person and book that way, but the app is much easier.
Okay, so I can delete my Park City Transit app? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not gonna say that. I think it's a worthwhile app. I'll let Park City Transit speak to that.
Okay, he's in next. You mentioned you are down drivers. What about labor shortages? And I ask this because this is what we're seeing at UTA, the PCSLC bus changing frequency, and certainly will have an impact on those who have been accustomed to using it. I mean, it's something that Summit County and Park City have subsidized for years. So did we drop that subsidy?
No, this is purely a result of a driver shortage, and it is not unique to Park City, Summit County, or even UTA. It is a nationwide shortage. It is the number one topic of conversation among all transit CEOs, directors, general managers. It is a crisis.
So what about those folks so using the PCSLC bus? I mean, is it something High Valley Transit is going to take over?
The idea was that eventually it would transition to High Valley Transit, and UTA wanted this transition to occur earlier, but of course we're operating out of a tent, so it wasn't really reasonable for us. So they've been working with us over the past year to try and make that transition. But we don't have the drivers, and we also don't have the facilities or vehicles. And then apparently it came to a point at UTA where they were looking at their winter service and said, we can't provide this service either. So it's not something anybody wanted. My partners at Park City and I are meeting every week, see what can we do? Can we bridge that gap? We don't know, but we're working on it. And it's not a good situation. I don't have a great answer yet. I don't know if we will have an answer because we're all in the same position, but we certainly acknowledge that this is really impactful for those riders that depended on that service. And I know that everyone has heard Chairperson Carson talk about how valuable the PCSLC Connect is to all the riders in the Wasatch back.
Yeah. And again, we've spent so much time and money kind of getting people finally to use it, and then to see that it, drops away, where it may make it that people just can't take it and have to, right, get back in their cars.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Let's talk a little bit also the fact that we will see an increase use of the local microtransit by our seasonal employees. They don't tend to have cars. Is High Valley Transit prepared to handle that onslaught of requests, especially as more of the workers find out about the service?
Yeah, we believe we are as prepared as we can be. We learned a lot of lessons in terms of scheduling and peak hours and number of vehicles on the road last year. So even finishing up the winter last year, we were already looking at our data and planning for this year. So we believe we're in a pretty good position. But you know, one of the great things about technology-driven transit is that we can adjust on the fly. And I can look at what happened this morning and adjust for this evening because the data is so robust. And so, yes, we are ready, and we welcome all those. That's why we're here, so those folks can use us to get to work.
Okay. Before I move subjects, anything else you wanted to mention about winter operations?
Just appreciate everyone's patience and pleasantness on our public transit system. It's hard to be an operator under these conditions, and our operators really appreciate when people are pleasant and treat them nicely.
Okay. Wanted to ask you about the Share e-bike program. That's getting put away for winter, or when?
So we don't have a date yet on the county side because our stations are a little bit more flexible. We don't store snow on top of our stations like they do in some other areas. We hope to stay open through December, you know, weather allowing. On the Park City side, as I mentioned, they have some areas where they share the space for snow storage. So likely they will be closing down mid-November, but that date will be released probably right within the next week here.
Okay. And what's the status on Summit County hiring a person to replace you there in the planning department as the regional transportation director?
Oh, we have a great replacement. He's been here almost a month now. He came from Compass in the Boise area. His name is Carl Miller. And I think those who have worked with him over the past month have thought he was fabulous. I mean, I have found him nothing but, you know, fitting right into the role. He has a lot of new ideas that he's bringing, and I'm really, really excited that the county was able to snag him and bring him in.
Okay, yeah, he's got some big projects ahead. I mean, when we talked about having the long-term transportation plan, right? I mean, he's got a big list of to-dos.
Yes, he does. But I think that goes for anyone who comes to Summit County.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Nope. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Thanks, Caroline.
Okay. Bye.
Caroline Rodriguez is the executive director of High Valley Transit. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Coming up now on 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Currently 43 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Once again, looking for sunshine today with a high near 69 and warmed up to 38 degrees in the Heber Valley. Again, sunny there with a high of 77. Well, the Park City Council will be meeting in work session tomorrow starting at 3:30. And in the studio with a preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias along with Transportation Director Matt Neely. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
First up, Bob, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, we're reporting that longtime economic development manager Jonathan Weidenhammer has resigned. The statement said it was because you and he didn't see eye to eye on the future of the Economic Development Department. Can you kind of give us an overview? I mean, what is your vision for that department?
Well, I guess first I take a step back and definitely want to thank John for his commitment to the community and the organization. To be fair, John and I go way back, and he's been with the organization for 23 years. I believe he started as an intern in our planning department and worked his way up. And, you know, we sort of celebrate his success and his commitment to the organization over a number of years. But we are very excited to sort of transform, look forward in the economic development department. For, you know, a lot of time we were focused on capital projects and building place, you know, growing the economy and special events. And I think, you know, looking forward, it's going to be far more analytical, a lot more focused on data and surveys and analytics. We're going to need some help with special financing in the community development world as we focus on redevelopment and public partnerships, affordable housing. So just, you know, taking a moment to step back and look forward.
Yeah. Does this have anything to do then with the contract, or I mean the resolution that you plan to approve, the sustainable tourism resolution? Does that right change the way that the city moves forward?
It does. I think there's an underlying shift at play, I think, overall about trying to create a little bit more balance between economy and quality of life here for our residents. We're year over year plowing money and resources into mitigating the resort economy and spending more and investing in supporting our neighborhoods where our year-round residents live. So we're very excited about the work that's happening at the Chamber. I think, you know, step one is that acknowledgement, just the willingness to be able to acknowledge that a shift is underway.
Yeah. And that's something I've kind of heard from the Chamber all along. It's like, okay, we'll get this plan done, but it's really up to city and county officials to implement the plan. So I guess, what does that look like going forward?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because, this is going to sound cliche, but we really are all in this together. And if there's a notion that just because the Chamber has put together a sustainable tourism plan that the responsibility is solely on them somehow, that would be a huge misnomer. To your point, I think it's, you know, residents are going to have to be involved, small businesses, big businesses, both the city and the county are going to have to be involved. And, you know, like I was saying, I think the first step out of the gate is being willing to acknowledge and recognize that a shift is underway and we want to strategically, you know, change the composition sometimes of the balance between growth and economy and our residential neighborhoods and quality of life. Step two is to huddle up and create the plan, and we're very thankful that the Chamber stepped up and did that for us. I don't think at the time we had the resources to do something like that. We were involved in COVID and trying to come out of COVID and get our community back together, and so they stepped up and brought their heads out of the sand and was able to deliver that for the community. And then to your point, I think implementation and accountability is on us.
Yeah. So will you replace the economic development manager position, or will that have some kind of new title?
I don't know yet. I think with John's departure, we have the opportunity to take a step back, consult with the mayor and council. We'll be consulting with staff as well. But we really will be looking to transform some of the duties and assignments and outputs of, you know, that office that has been in place for almost 20 years, 15 to 20 years now.
Okay. So it's a council decision whether or not to replace the position.
Well, I think it's technically an administrative decision, but we want to transform, we want to renovate and modernize the organization. We'll be focused on data and analytics and performance. There will be a bunch of special financing tools we'll be seeking some experience in. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. You know, Jonathan just announced his resignation the other day. We're obviously trying to send him out on a high note and celebrate his 23 years of commitment to the community and organization. And so, you know, we'll be back with some sort of a rebrand.
Okay. Let's turn to Matt here. Matt, you'll be presenting in work session at 3:30, council getting a review of the winter transportation plan. They've got, what, three options to choose from, or they can decide whatever they want to do, I guess, huh?
Well, we're going to go to the council with three options. And so my team has been working on figuring out strategies for being able to address the goals of the city. And so, you know, our first option is we're looking at an express service between the ski resorts in Richardson Flat, Park and Ride. And what we're talking about is providing a 20-minute frequency for a couple of specific routes, which is the blue and the green route, during the peak hours with a microtransit service, which is new to Park City, and being able to provide additional service to some of those areas within the city.
Okay, and that comes at a cost of about 1.8?
Yeah, that's correct.
Does that include the, because later on in the agenda, you've got a contract up for adoption of $850,000 or something for microtransit. Is that on top of the 1.8, or that includes the?
That includes the microtransit.
Okay, all right.
And so the cost to be able to stand up microtransit is $850,000. And so council gave us $500,000 earlier this year for microtransit. And so we just need a little additional funding to be able to fully implement it.
Okay. The second option is what?
The second option is there would provide no park and ride service at Richardson Flat, but we would reduce or increase frequency on the red, yellow, blue, and green routes, taking them from 30 to 20 minutes. And this option still includes the microtransit service. And we would be providing that service in Park Meadows, Thames, Canyon, Royal Street, and Park City Heights.
All right. And what's that cost?
That cost is $580,000.
Okay. Plus the $850,000 to do the microtransit?
No. So that cost is also included in this. And so it's a reduced cost because we're not providing all the additional transit services that option one includes. And so we're just using our existing routes and just increasing the frequency on those routes.
All right, and then status quo is no negligible cost there?
Yeah, so the third option is just go with what we have. You know, we've got the paid reservation system that Park City Mountain is implementing, and so there's an option that we can just see what that looks like and see what changes that brings to the city.
And as the expert, then what are you recommending?
So, you know, the idea is to provide an intercept for the people coming into Park City and being able to find a place for them to park. We know that parking is a challenge within the city. And so, you know, from that perspective, having a park and ride lot is a viable option. There are some challenges with Richardson Flat, you know, the location. It's not convenient for people coming in off of 248, 40, and 224. So there are some challenges there and the cost. But park and ride, I still think, is a great idea for the city. But I think at the bare minimum, being able to enhance the transit service to be able to provide more frequent service to the people within the community, as well as people coming to visit so that they can get to the resorts and get to the businesses, as well as get around town.
Yeah. So are you recommending option one just to see what that looks like? If we can capture people, if they're willing to take the little bit maybe of extra time to, I don't know, it probably balance out if you're looking for a parking spot. You've got a parking spot. Now you just got to wait for a bus.
You know, I think option one would be my preferred option if everybody was all in. And so I think because of the cost and because of the effort that it's required to implement that option, I think there could be some challenges.
Yeah, so what we don't have yet are the bus rapid transit lanes for the buses. So people getting off at Richardson Flat are now going to find themselves in the flow of traffic. Granted, it may be a little bit less traffic because now they're at Richardson Flat instead of coming into town. But I guess, are we putting the cart before the horse here? Because we really don't know how it's going to work when people get on a bus and actually get to move ahead of traffic.
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at that, and we recognize that, you know, going into Park City, that there is the bus on shoulder option. So they can get into town, but then there's a challenge getting from town back out to Richardson Flat because we don't have that same opportunity. And so, you know, we do have a grant that High Valley Transit received for $55 million to be able to do a BRT lane. That comes from Kimball Junction into Old Town. And so we're starting to see some great things coming to the city. And so we're just hoping to start to build on that, you know, as the years come by.
Yeah. So if we do go with the micro transit, again, with one or two, we heard just from Caroline about labor shortages. Are we going to be able to meet the demand?
So, you know, earlier this year, council approved a budget to increase the salary for our transit operators. And so with that, we have seen a significant increase in our hiring pool. And, you know, right now we have about 57 transit operators, and we need 70 just to operate our active winter operations plan. If we were to do option one, we would need 94 operators. And so, you know, right now we're optimistic based on the number of applicants that we have received. And so we are looking forward to that. And what's even been more surprising with the applicants is how many already come qualified. And so that's really been a great blessing for us.
Yeah. I was talking to Caroline about the app. People using microtransit will need to use the High Valley Transit app. Are we going to just maintain the current app that we have?
We are going to maintain that app.
Okay.
And so we can still provide that regular service that everyone is used to.
All right. And that just would be for the buses moving in and out of town, no microtransit requests.
Correct.
Will there be some kind of link eventually, or it can't work that way?
So we're looking at that and understanding that this is a pilot for this winter. And we're interested just to see how well the community accepts microtransit and how well it's used.
All right. Anything else you want to mention on winter transportation?
No, I think that, we're looking forward to hearing what council direction they provide to us and then taking the next steps.
Okay. Matt, back to you. Fractional ownership back on the agenda. This is scheduled for approval. Is it going to do what the community wanted?
Well, we hope so. This has been several months of extensive work by the planning staff, planning commissions, city council, residents, HOAs, sort of you name it. I was fortunate enough to be here when we went through the whole disruptive technology with regard to nightly rentals and online platforms and Uber and Lyfts and rideshare. And, this is sort of these disruptive technologies. They find new means and methods to corner a market share. And this is something that we weren't contemplating for a long time in our primarily single family and residential zones. So the quick summary of, we're just more or less defaulted to an extension of our existing zoning restrictions to areas that already allow for timeshare in private clubs. So there's a comprehensive map that's on our website. It's on the planning department's website that we've shared up there. So if you could find the area of town that you live in, you'll be able to see the overlay zone. But basically, this has been a ton of work over time. We are trying to protect the quality and sanctity of our primarily residential neighborhoods. This is a new and innovative means and method for having and owning and acquiring property in cities and towns, perhaps across the country. The focus right now is primarily in these resort-related areas. I encourage people to visit our webpage, and this is something we're likely to have to revisit. We're not sure we're going to get this perfect on the first try, but something that we already built into the ordinance that we'd come back and revisit it within 3 to 5 years.
So what about those that already have a fractional ownership home in these single-family neighborhoods? They're grandfathered?
Well, perhaps. There might be some tools that we can use through the licensing system and then obviously working with the businesses themselves. But I think the first thing that we're trying to do is sort of stop the bleeding and stop the hemorrhaging before any of these additional properties are put into play in our primarily residential and single-family neighborhoods. Get ahead of it.
Have you heard from those fractional ownership owners?
We have, and to be honest, they've been part of the discussion, and thus far they've been incredibly respectful and want to be part of the dialogue. I think, to be fair, a lot of them see themselves as part of our community and quality second homeowners. But clearly there's a different type of use underway in these primarily single-family residential areas that weren't necessarily constructed for this type of activity and activation and intensity of use.
So moving on, speed limit recommendations. We had heard at a meeting last month a proposal by Councilmember Jeremy Rebell to basically drop the speed limit, everything the city has a say over, to 15 miles per hour. What's the latest there?
Well, that created a tremendous amount of feedback, and I'll compliment our council member for a minute. I think the goal was actually to really sort of poke the public and say, wake up, we have an opportunity here. For years people have complained about speeding in their neighborhoods and the streets where they lived, and so I believe the council member's intent was to really get everyone's attention and say, we have this wonderful opportunity that we've wanted for a long time. The legislature has finally empowered cities and towns to be able to make more creative and reflective decisions of who they are. And so staff has come back, the professional staff and engineering, the police department, transportation, with a three-tiered system, which has more or less a gradation of speeds from 25, 20, and then down to 15. For those streets that are desirable of perhaps a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit and weren't classified that way, we have inputted sort of a petition system through our Neighborhood First program. So if you live on a street and the classification doesn't reflect the needs and wants and desires of you and your fellow residents and neighborhoods, there is also a petition process. But the empirical evidence says slower speeds reduce the severity of accidents, period. But they also show that arbitrarily low speed limits without improvements in the right-of-way and proper enforcement and otherwise can backfire. And so, again, this is a little bit of a balancing act. We've received a tremendous amount of public input, and I know the mayor and council want to thank everyone for stepping up and writing their emails and making their phone calls.
Well, it seems like the first comment I hear coming out of people's mouths is, what if we just enforced the 25-mile-per-hour speed limit? Maybe we wouldn't think that 15 miles per hour is needed.
So we do, and we frequently enforce our speed limits, and I want to give a lot of credit to our police officers, the men and women in uniform that are out there on the streets, and they're obviously very gracious to those that we pull over. Their observations, empirically proven, is most of the problem are our residents themselves, and it's not often the cut through, you know, tourist or visitor. It's typically those of us that are trying to get to school or work or church, and we're running late, or we're running behind for a piano practice or a soccer practice or our bike ride. Nonetheless, though, our law enforcement community has heard the call for additional enforcement loud and clear. And so our parking team, our code enforcement team, and our police officers have been out doing high visibility speed enforcement in our neighborhoods. And so we'll have some additional data on that action in probably 3 or 4 months. And I think it'll be really interesting to see who it is that we're pulling over.
Okay. Yeah, a really great spot would be Marsac Avenue there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
So high visibility. We've been in the Thanes, Aspen Springs neighborhood. We've been in Prospector, and we've been over in Park Meadows for the last 3 weeks since the special events sort of season wound down. And I think, you know, we've had some thumbs up out the windows, and we've had some other fingers out the windows. But we have to compliment the men and women in law enforcement. It's a tough job to be on the front line, pulling over a neighbor, you know, sometimes a block away from where they live. So we compliment them on their graciousness and treating people with respect.
Okay, so what the council will be considering at its meeting is this tiered approach.
Yeah, is this sort of overlaid system where there is a comprehensive reduction in speeds in the residential neighborhoods in our community, and then also a petition option for those that, you know, don't see the quality of life reflected in the speed limit on the street where they live.
And it is not a blanket 15 mile per hour throughout town.
It is not. That was an attention grabber, and it worked, quite frankly. We got a lot of attention. And I think people are excited to know that the legislature has empowered cities and towns to make these decisions themselves.
Okay. I know that you want to remind us about tomorrow's Olympic bid community conversation.
Yeah, you know, this is just one of many ongoing conversations I've attended to myself, facilitated by Mountain Mediation. Really important opportunity for people to get out there and get heard and be involved. The Olympics is, you know, in some sense, it gives a lot of people anxiety and concern, and other people, it's an amazing opportunity and something that they themselves, their employer, or their children want to be part of. It's a community conversation. Just really encourage people to show up and turn out.
Okay. Oh, I also just want to mention, since I am part of that class, the senior housing survey presentation that'll be made. You've probably looked at the report, but I mean, it's just a presentation that the class had asked for. There are some recommendations there, though. Have you guys had a chance to look at those, and will they be discussed at some other time?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. My recollection is there's 7 firm recommendations, and maybe 7 or 9. I apologize if I get that wrong. As you know, I've been part of the leadership program for several years, and this is the culmination of their class project. But there are some pretty firm recommendations in there, some, I think, which probably came out of the survey that was conducted. I believe there was over 500 or 600 responses, and some also seem like they came out of your experience on City Tour in Boise and other communities. And so by way of an example, there's a recommendation to form a joint housing authority. There's a recommendation to immediately move forward on some sort of a public-private partnership in the Woodside area where the senior center is, creating a new senior center and maximize density. There are some very firm recommendations in there about how the leadership class, through the survey and exploring other communities, is making recommendations. There's a recommendation in there for facilitating in Summit County a continuing care retirement community. So wonderful work. Congratulations to the class. A lot of this aligns with our housing goals and development projects underway. But this lets us know that we have advocates in these areas and we have community support. So this is really helpful.
So again, it would come back for further discussion, or...
I believe so. I don't see why it wouldn't. I mean, each year the leadership class comes in and has an opportunity in about, you know, 15 minutes to a half an hour to present to the mayor and city council. And all sorts of community classes are, activated on or frequently coming back. I mean, there are a myriad of open space and trails projects in the past. And so our hope is that we come back regularly and discuss these things.
Okay. Hey, Matt Dias, Matt Neely, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:51. KPCW News Time now, 8:52. Good morning. Well, election season is in full swing, and wading through what's true and what's not can feel overwhelming at times. In contentious political races, misinformation can be a common factor. From KUER, Sean Higgins reports.
Gaud Margani is the Republican candidate for Salt Lake County Clerk and has distanced himself from claims of election fraud. But the Salt Lake Tribune revealed Margani accused Democrats of cheating to win in 2020 in social media posts. Independent Senate candidate Evan McMullen also held a press conference to debunk an attack ad where he was shown saying the Republican base is racist. Avery Holton is a communications professor at the University of Utah. He said while it can feel overwhelming to be bombarded with information in the run-up to an election, it's all about what you do after hearing those things.
I would say not to tune out, but to be selective. Be smart, and then check these folks out. Really check them out. Just because you hear something that sounds saccharine from someone doesn't mean it's all going to be sweet.
Holton says it's smart to check multiple sources after hearing a story and take a break if you feel overwhelmed. Sean Higgins, KUER News.
Summit Community Gardens is wrapping up another growing season. On the phone with details, Executive Director Sloan Johnson. Good morning, Sloan.
Good morning, Leslie.
So gardens are being put to bed. What do people need to do with plot owners?
Yeah, so, you know, now is the time of year where we want to clean up our gardens and get the soil ready so that we're increasing the nutrients of the soil during the winter. So what we have people do when they come to the garden is clear out their garden of all the weeds, pull out all their crops that they've planted, and you can either pull them out or just cut them and leave the roots in. Some of the roots actually continue to add nutrients into the soil if you leave them in for the winter. And then cover your bed with compost, and that compost will seep into the soil over the winter just to increase the nutrients in the soil that has been taken out as the plants grew over the summer. So this is really important just to maintain soil health and make your garden so that it'll be successful next summer.
Yeah, flowers were beautiful this year. My squash did well, but very few tomatoes compared to last year. So how are you summing up the summer growing season?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's funny because we kind of walk around the garden and look at, you know, what successes people are having and not having. And, you know, we had a couple crops plots that had the most amazing tomatoes. And ours, we weren't as successful with our tomatoes as well. But our squashes did well. Our milpa garden did fantastic with the corn, which I've rarely seen corn grow in Park City because it takes a long growing season. But we did have some good corn that grew. Our beans, our peas, our radishes, beets did not do as well for us this summer. And I didn't see very many plot runners who had good beets. Potatoes were fantastic. So, you know, every year is a little bit different, what does well and what doesn't. And I think everybody has a little different success.
All right. So when do signups for next season start?
Yeah, so we're going to be sending out an email to all our plot runners at the end of this month to renew their plots. Probably around the end of November, we'll open up to the wait list. So now is a good time to get on the wait list and then expect to hear from us in November, the end of November.
Okay. You split the hives last spring. How did they do this summer?
Yeah, we did. So actually our hives are doing quite well. There was definitely a lot of trial and error and I wasn't sure if they were going to make it. But we have three strong hives. So I split the hive we had, and then we caught a swarm, and all of them are successful now. I actually had the kids camp help harvest honey this week, so we have quite a bit more honey than I had expected. So they are doing really well, and I think they're going to do well over the winter. They're strong enough that I think we'll have all three hives do well this winter and make it through.
All right. Do you have honey to sell?
Not yet.
Okay.
I think we're going to be probably just, you know, giving the honey away to some of our donors. And I don't think we're going to be selling any honey this year.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Yes, the only other thing is that we are, you know, we're getting the garden cleaned up and ready for the winter, and we definitely can use some volunteers. So we're working on putting together volunteer days, but if you have any interest in volunteering in the garden, please reach out. Go to summitcommunitygardens.org and click on the volunteer tab. And send us a message, because we've got lots of different jobs and we would love your help.
Okay. Sloan, appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:58. Well, as many found out, Park City Schools have a new holiday this year. They'll be closed for Yom Kippur today, a Jewish high holiday. This is the Day of Atonement, and it's considered the holiest day of the Jewish year. It marks the end of the High Holy Days, a holiday period that began with Rosh Hashanah at the observance of the Jewish New Year. Yom Kippur offering a chance for people to change their fate through prayer, repentance, and charity. Jewish temples have religious services. Some people fast from sunup to sundown, while others don't drive or work. It falls on different dates each year, depending on the Jewish calendar. And again, it's today, and schools are closed. Mary Morgan is co-president of the Park City Education Association and sits on the calendar committee. She said in the 25 years she's been teaching in Park City, this is the first time Yom Kippur has been recognized as a holiday. While she's not Jewish, she says working on Yom Kippur for the Jewish community is akin to working on Christmas Day for those who celebrate Christmas. She said it's more important than ever that the district acknowledge the needs of our Jewish community. While the exact number of Jewish students, teachers, and employees in Park City isn't known, Park City's Temple Har Shalom counts more than 400 families as members. Schools reopen tomorrow, October 6th.